Matt Nix, the creator of the television series Burn Notice, is quoted as saying, "Spies have the same kinds of needs and desires that everybody else does," which is funny. The best kind of comedy derives from that kind of truth. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Today on the show, we'll be chatting with a gentleman whose life is a spy, and the book he's written about that life embodies Mr. Nix's philosophy. American Spy, Wry Reflections on My Life in the CIA by H.K. Roy is replete with fascinating firsthand accounts of his time in the world of espionage, presented with a liberal mix of dry gallows humor. Listeners will learn that the employment of his craft, even at the hands of a master, can sometimes wander into the bizarre and even border on the absurd. Yes, being a spy can be exciting, full of exotic locales and foods and intriguing people, but can also be monotonous. Paperwork. Yep. Believe it or not, being a spy involves paperwork. Lots of it. In his book, Mr. Roy gives us some ridiculous examples that we'll be sharing today. He's a great storyteller, and you know how we love to tell stories here on American Warrior Radio. So welcome to the program, Mr. H.K. Roy.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I tell you, I've been looking forward to this for a long time. So let me just start off a little bit, HK. Another quote, Roger Moore, who was not a spy but played a spy in film, he played 007, he said, "You can't be a real spy and have everybody in the world know who you are and what your drink is. That's just ridiculously funny." I'm kind of surprised this book actually ever made it to the public.
Well, I had to run it past the CIA's Publications Review Board to make sure that I wasn't revealing any classified information. And so that's how these books come to be, only with sort of CIA approval.
Well, and I really appreciate it, HK. Right off the bat in your book, you explain that, you know, you're very cautious about protecting people, secrets, other agents, et cetera. But at the same time, you share that, you know, the American public has the right to know what our enemies, in most cases, already know. And so tell us a little bit about your thought process leading up to this book. You'd started down this path for a little while, took a pause, but then the time came, huh?
Yes. And well, it's always a balancing act in terms of, you know, what you don't want to reveal sources and methods, but at the same time, you know, the American public does have a right to know what's going on. What governments and government officials should never do is hide behind, you know, the concept of secrecy or say something is classified when it's not, just as an excuse to not reveal something. But there are legitimate security concerns in terms of protecting sources and methods. And so I did my best to strike the right balance and got it approved. And I started on this process actually many years ago. The first chapter, you may recall, is about an adventure I had in Sarajevo in 1995 during the war there. And I had to get out under some pretty sketchy circumstances. It was all classified, but then a couple of years later, my story was on the front page of the LA Times. My name wasn't in it, but the story was told, and someone in the government had decided to leak it for sort of geopolitical reasons. We, at the time, we needed to get the Iranians out of Bosnia in order to bring peace to the region, and so that's why somebody leaked the story. But my thought was, well, if you're going to tell my story, I should be able to tell it because I'll tell it in more detail and tell it properly. And so I wrote an article, which chapter one is based on, about that Sarajevo adventure and got it approved by Publications Review Board. And so that's sort of what kicked off the whole process.
Well, I'd like to talk more about that later in the show. And I'm smiling here because folks, read this book. It is an exceptional book. And I'm smiling because, HK, you use the word adventure. And I'm, you know, using the air quotes here. I guess that's an appropriate word. It's not my first language. But let's go into the Wayback Machine a little bit. I'm guessing, to join the CIA, do you just get a random call telling you that if you want to serve your country, you should go to this unmarked building or ask for Mr. Smith? Or in your case, becoming a 13-year CIA operations officer started with a side business as a switchblade smuggler. I guess that's as good a start as any, huh?
That's right. So I grew up in Arizona and spent a lot of time from the time I was about 8 years old going to Mexico. And I quickly fell in love with things like explosives and fireworks and switchblades and stilettos, as did my classmates. And so before I would head south, I would take everybody's order and purchase everything out of pocket, smuggle it back into the U.S. under my unsuspecting parents' car seats. You know, I was in seventh grade or whatever. And then resell everything to my classmates at a perfectly reasonably marked up price. And so that's, at the time, I knew nothing about the CIA, but, you know, looking back, that sort of probably helped me a little bit to get through some things.
Well, sure, you already had the chops. Now you can get in and out of Bosnia, Cuba, you know, Moscow, wherever you need to go. I mean, that makes perfect sense. When I was growing up, we lived on the Arizona border before fireworks were legal, and literally to 8 miles inside the New Mexico border was this little wide spot in the road that, I mean, the only reason it existed, I think, was to sell fireworks to people from Arizona. So we had our own, we had a similar business going on there. Now, HK, the thing that surprised me, not just the fact that you're able to publish this book, but I'm surprised the CIA would even have you or put up with you. What, I mean, sir, on behalf of the nation's security, what exactly is your relationship with John Hinckley Jr.?
Yeah, well, first off, they weren't always happy to put up with me, and I was kind of walking a tight wire at many times. And as I mentioned in the book, you know, the CIA grew out of the OSS, and the people who joined the OSS sort of had a reputation for, you want to serve your country, but at the same time, you don't have a lot of patience for bureaucracy. And unfortunately, the CIA, even though it's not as bad as other government agencies, is still a bureaucracy. So there was always that. But so John Hinckley, I know why you're mentioning that. When I went through, I was in law school in D.C. when I applied to the CIA. And the whole process took almost a year. And part of the process is an extensive background investigation. You know, they talk to your neighbors and your friends and your employer and your neighbors back home in Arizona. And it was at that point that I thought my application would go off the rails, because about 1 year earlier, I'd gotten married in law school and suffering from some pre-wedding jitters. I decided as a joke to send out some of the wedding invitations to some celebrities like the Queen of England and, you know, the Prime Minister of Israel. And I also sent one to John Hinckley, who was in, I don't know if everybody will remember this, but he had tried to kill, he shot President Reagan, I think it was in 81 when I was in D.C., and by the time I sent him an invitation, he was at St. Elizabeth's psychiatric institution. He was criminally insane. And nobody replied to my invitation. The Queen ignored it, but we actually got the RSVP card back from John Hinckley saying, you know, sorry, can't make your wedding. I've got other commitments. He actually said that. And wishing you a happy, happy life. And so, you know, a year later, I'm applying to the CIA, and I thought, well, there goes my application, because they have to know, and they must wonder why I have this relationship with the guy who tried to kill President Reagan. They, you know, prisons monitor mail, and although this wasn't a prison, he was, you know, in the psychiatric institution for trying to kill the president. And so I assumed that would be in some database that, you know, H.K. Roy is clearly a close friend of Mr. Hinckley, and that would come up in the background investigation, and they would have to tell me, sorry, we can't hire you. But much to my pleasant surprise, it never came up. And so I learned early on that the government system for doing background checks isn't foolproof.
Sometimes it works in your favor, and sometimes it doesn't. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're speaking with A.K.A. Roy. His book is American Spy, Wry Reflections on My Life in the CIA. You just heard an example of why I think the title of the book should have been, you know, American Spy from Delinquent to CIA Agent. But we'll hear lots more great topics. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking with my new favorite author, H.K. Roy. He has got just a peach of a book called American Spy, Wry Reflections on My Life in the CIA. HK, now, we get a lot of books, and I read all of them. Well, most of them. You know, if they're bad at the open, sometimes it goes on the shelf or you know, to the local Goodwill or something. But well, like one of your online reviewers, I got your book, I thumbed through the table of contents, and I immediately turned to the chapter called CIA Safe Sex Practices. Now, I thought, oh, I'm going to like this guy. Now, the reason is because you weren't talking about abstinence or birth control, but actually performing the deed on a safe, steel, tumblers, locks. It's a family show, so we're not going to get into that, but I just want to tease our listeners. And, you know, we don't want to give too much of the book away, but let's talk a little bit about the fun, frivolity, and almost getting killed. At the opening of the book, you're sitting on a warm Mexican beach when you receive an extortion threat from an Iranian-backed Shiite militia, and your response was, meh, whatever. So you're talking about Bosnia and your first encounter with the Iranians when you dodged that first big bullet. Tell us a story about that, HK, because that's pretty compelling stuff. And you alluded it to the in the intro.
Right. Well, Iran has been a kind of a recurring theme throughout my career, and even going back to, you know, remember the Iranian hostage situation in, mm-hmm. I think it was late 1979 or 80. You know, I was in college then, but we had, as you may recall, a Marine from Arizona who was one of the hostages. And so it meant a lot to me even when I was, in college. And then I was lucky enough to see the hostage parade in D.C. one week after Reagan's inauguration. And that was a pretty moving experience as well, to see these hostages. They were in, you know, metro buses, but going down Pennsylvania Avenue one week after the inauguration. And so the Sarajevo story, which is the first chapter, I'll put it in context. I had served already in the Balkans in the former Yugoslavia for 2 years in Belgrade. And then in the late 1989, the Berlin Wall came down and communism was going away in all these countries in Eastern Europe, and except for Yugoslavia, where it went from Cold War into Civil War. And Croatia was the first big war there. And I covered that for the CIA because I was already in country. And there weren't a lot of us in those days who were specialists in the former Yugoslavia. And so I had experience covering the war in Croatia, during which time I was also tasked to establish an official service-to-service relationship between the CIA and the new Croatian government's security service. Well, by 1995, the war in Bosnia next door had been raging for 3 years, and for the most part, the U.S. government had not been involved, and for better or for worse, and the Bosnian Muslims were being slaughtered by the Serbs. You may recall there were, you know, essentially were the concentration camps across Bosnia where they were starving. There were rape camps, lots of atrocities, and Sarajevo was the capital. And so in July of 95, I was PCS, I was permanently based in the U.S., but I was often asked to go back to the Balkans to do certain things, like in July of 95, they decided that we need to open a CIA station in Sarajevo, which was at the time involved in this, you know, really bad war. It was surrounded by Serb forces, and it was almost impossible just to get in or out. And I was sent there to do that and to establish our first service-to-service relationship with the Bosnian Security Service. The idea being I would, number one, collect intelligence on what's happening there, but also on Serb targets, Bosnian Serb targets, because NATO was going to go in soon after I got there and get involved and bomb the Serbs and try and relieve some of the pressure on the Bosnian Muslims. So my concern was just getting in and out of Sarajevo during a war zone. There was a lot of sniper fire and random mortars, and just driving over Mount Igman, which was this mountain between the outside and Sarajevo, was very dangerous. And it's all in the book on how I went about that. And I got in and started to meet with my Bosnian counterpart. He was the head of the Bosnian Security Service, and he was very good about providing all the intelligence I needed. And while I was there, a place called Srebrenica, which, you know, people, some of your viewers may remember, it was a so-called safe haven protected by UN troops, but they didn't really have the ability or the mandate to protect them. And so Srebrenica was overrun by the Bosnian Serb forces. General Ratko Mladic was in charge. He was one of the top two war criminals after that. And I reported on that. They killed between 6,000 and 8,000 innocent people over the course of a couple of days. And initially, headquarters and people in Washington didn't even believe it. And my reporting was going directly to the White House, to the Pentagon, to the State Department, unfiltered, which is really a lot of fun if you're a CIA officer, you know, to have your information be that anticipated and valued. And so that was a lot of fun. That's sort of what it's all about. But the Iranians weren't really my concern. You know, this was a war zone. When I did ask the head of the service, I'll call him Marco, about the Iranian presence there, all he would say is they're welcome here, and he wouldn't talk about it. One day, when I went to my meeting with him at the Interior Ministry, and just getting to and from the meetings was kind of hairy because there wasn't a lot of traffic on the streets because of sniper fire, so you had to drive really fast and hope nobody would shoot at you. And I showed up from my meeting, and instead of meeting him upstairs like I normally did, somebody pointed me to a little room downstairs and said, go meet with Marco over there. He wants to see you over there. So I said, all right. And I went into this little room. Marco was there, and they were all in camouflage fatigues because even though it was ostensibly a civilian entity, it was still a war zone. And there was another guy in the room with him, a big, tall, Middle Eastern-looking guy with a beard, also in fatigues. And it was kind of weird. And Marco said, oh, sorry, HK, I'll meet you upstairs in 5 minutes. So I said, all right, I met him upstairs. You know, it was a weird thing, and it struck me as odd, but I didn't know what was going on. At any rate, I found out, I'm thinking within 24 hours, you know, it's been a long time, but it's my recollection, within 24 hours from a very 100% reliable source that the Middle Eastern-looking guy was the head of the Iranian intelligence service in Sarajevo. He had tasked Marco, who was under his control, I found out, to bring me into the room to showcase me to him because he and the Iranian intelligence service planned to pick me up, kidnap me off the street one day, and do all kinds of nasty things to me, after which I would no doubt be killed. And I knew this because a colleague of mine named William Buckley was in Beirut 10 years earlier, and they got him there. And I write about him in the book as well. And he was eventually tortured to death. If you're captured by the Iranians, they will not trade you. You know, there's no hope of getting out. They will never show their hand. They won't spike the football, you know, like we did right after we got Soleimani, and it will not be pleasant. So,
HK, I mean, what comes to mind to me is almost like, you know, at the livestock auctions where you see the, you know, the auctioneer parading the prized steer in front of potential buyers, and that's the sense I got from your you know, quote unquote meeting. How long was it? I mean, pretty soon thereafter, you must have walked out of there with, you know, the hair on the back of your neck standing up.
Yeah, and right at that moment when I met him, like I said, I knew it was weird, but at the time we did not know that the Iranians controlled the Bosnian intelligence service. We knew that later, and this was when I got this report within 24 hours, that was our very first evidence that this was the case. And so I didn't know it immediately until I got this report, which I can't tell you exactly how I got that or what it was, but all I can say is it was 100% reliable. I was able to read the Iranians' cable traffic back and forth with his headquarters in Tehran. He described me physically. You know, this is why he wanted to see me in the flesh, because they like to do that sometimes. Sure. To see the target in person. And I was just a target of opportunity for them. You know, this was turf they controlled at the time. There were no Americans there to speak of, certainly no troops. You know, this was before troops got involved. And here I show up and I declare myself in true name as a CIA officer, which is also a difficult thing to do when you spent most of your career trying not to come to the attention of a local government. And, you know, so I was just a target of opportunity, and they couldn't pass it up.
Well, it's some pretty scary stuff. So, you know, it's interesting in talking or reading your book, you describe how your colleagues or family give you a hard time, and I can relate to that. My brother was in a branch of the military that did similar things, and just whenever he was sent somewhere that we knew about that was peaceful, you could almost guarantee something was going to pop pretty soon. You know, Middle East, Panama, and that's so. Yeah. You know, don't ever come visit us, HK. Just stay on that Mexican beach or wherever you are. Ladies and gentlemen, we come back. I want to follow up on this story and touch on something else in the book that HK calls Bohica moments. I won't tell you what that stands for because, again, it's a family show and you need to read the book. And also, we'll get the answer to the question, did he inspire a Saturday Night Live skit? Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're speaking with H.K. Roy. He's got a great new book out called American Spy, Wry Reflections on My Life in the CIA. H.K., I teased a little bit about, before the break, about your time. And you know, when I read the book, something that jumped out at me a little bit is just often the absurdity of the situations in the bureaucracy. In your book, you've got a sort of a reproduction of a cable back to Washington and their response. And again, this is not secret stuff. It's just, it's sort of more illustrative. But two things. One, just the extent to which the intelligence is good, but so often it gets ignored or overlooked or just lots of reasons this stuff doesn't happen. I mean, you're really literally describing the thousands upon thousands of people are being slaughtered over there. And the response was, we don't believe you, basically.
Yeah, and that is like a common theme throughout my career, you know, just the absurdity sometimes of, you know, you're in a crazy place reporting as best you can, and sometimes the information is not accurate, but for the most part, you know, we obviously do our best to make sure that it is. And so there's lots of absurdity. Either they don't believe it or they want to wait until it's confirmed by somebody else, like, you know, Serb propaganda radio out of Pale, which is ridiculous.
Right.
Or they're waiting for overhead imagery, which will come in a day or two, you know, and you say, well, I'm, you know, you paid me to come here and I'm here and this is what I'm seeing and learning from my sources. So that part is frustrating. But then also, as you alluded to, this almost surreal situation where, you know, you're reporting from a war zone, but you also have to keep up with the admin matters. You have to say, okay, I spent $20 on gas and, you know, $50 for per diem, and they'll come back and say, well, we can't reimburse you for the gas because you didn't get a receipt. You know, just crazy little things like that. But that sort of, you know, that just characterizes the reality of working for the government, no matter what the situation.
And it gets even worse. I mean, we're looking here, you mentioned the gas. It was purchased on the black market. So, yeah, those guys don't issue receipts, as best I can tell, you know.
Right.
One sheep, $50, paid by the agent to BSA soldier who was about to shoot the sheep. Return the sheep to rightful owners, a hungry group of refugees, no receipt. And their response is, it's ridiculous. So let's talk about that. And again, that's part of the reason I really enjoyed this book, because you have a way of painting very serious situations in a manner with that sort of gallows humor that it really engages us. And you refer to these sorts of situations in your book, I guess on CIA, you had a phrase for it, Bohica. We, again, won't explain what that stands for. But, HK, I attended the University of Arizona. About 3 weeks before I graduated, I got a parking ticket. And I chose just to ignore it because, like, I'm out of here. See you guys.
Yep.
You know. Well, and it, I don't know, it was $15 or something. Well, it turns out that if you don't pay those fines after so many years, they actually shred your diploma. And I thought, well, that's a heck of a thing. You had a similar but potentially much more expensive Bohica moment that had to do with some, like some advance money, $150 worth of advance money in Sarajevo. And just walk us through that story real quick, because that goes to show how ridiculous the bureaucracy can be.
Yeah. Well, first of all, your military listeners will know exactly what bohica means, because okay. I think the expression is very widespread there as well. It essentially has to do with being screwed by your own bureaucracy in many cases, often with personnel matters. So yeah, I had a string of bohica moments in the government, the last of which, before I resigned, was they said I owed $150. And I said, why? And they said, because when you were in Sarajevo, there was these JSOC operators who came over from Zagreb, and they actually drove me in from Split, Croatia, to Sarajevo. And they brought me an advance of 500 Deutschmarks, because at the time, the Deutschmark was the currency in Bosnia. And I left Bosnia so soon because of the Iranian threat that I never even had to touch this 500 Deutschmark advance. So after I got out, I went back to headquarters in Washington, and I tried to turn it in there. And he said, no, you have to turn it in the field. I said, well, I just left the field, and I can't. And I explained the circumstances. And they thought about it. They said, all right, well, you can turn it in this other office. So I went, to another office across town, and they said, we can't except foreign currency, you have to convert it to dollars, and then we'll take it. So
the CIA cannot accept foreign currency.
No, well, not at headquarters.
All right.
There's just all kinds of stories.
Would they accept 10 goats?
Overseas, they
Sorry,
would.
I interrupted. Go ahead with your story.
At any rate, by the time the process was done, and I forgot, I turned the money back in. I didn't ask for the advance. I didn't spend it. I didn't touch it. I turned it back in. So I thought, end of story. A year or so later, when I was getting ready to resign, they said, you owe $150. And I said, no, I don't. And I said, and I explained why. And I said, the reason it was $150 is because of currency fluctuations and bank commissions and all that, the 500 Deutschmarks had lost $150 worth of value by the time I turned it back in. So they said, you need to pay us that $150. And I explained why. No, that's, you absorb it, and here's why. It was pretty clear cut to me. And then I ignored it. A year later, they said, when you resign, you could either take your retirement money as a cash payout or leave it in the CIA retirement fund. And I said, I'll take the cash payout. And they said, no, you can't have it until you pay us the $150 back. And so I had no choice. It wasn't about the money. It was about the principle of the thing. But that was my final bohica moment. And as you also may have noticed, the entire book is really just one lead up to the punchline, which is that no matter how many of these bohica moments there are, if the government asks me to help out in Iraq mm-hmm. or wherever, I will help. I will just do it, even though I know there's a good chance they'll ignore the intelligence or whatever. But because of that, I'm known to my former colleagues as the last of the Bohicans.
I love it. I want to talk a little more about that, because I do want to wrap up. We were sharing some lighthearted stories here, but this is serious business and serious risk. And honestly, sir, you are a patriot, and I appreciate that. I tell you, one chapter that had me rolling as I was reading it, it deals with your very brief stint at the State Department Visa Desk in Belgrade.
Right. That was it was in the visa section in the embassy there. All embassies all around the world have a visa section, a consulate, and they're typically pretty crazy places. And I helped out there because I had a friend who needed my help, and I spoke the language, and I also had some immigration law experience from law school, so it was pretty easy to catch on, what needed to be done. But there were lots of funny stories from that experience. Did you have one that you wanted me to?
No, I just overall, it was hilarious, because it highlighted to me the bureaucracy and how bad it can be, and well, particularly in other countries. I think you also talked about the experience with a last minute. Oh, you need an exit visa before you leave. Well, how do I do that? Well. Yeah,
I mean, that was That was in Baghdad last April, actually.
That reminds me of my life trying to get back in the United States from Mexico, but that's a story for another day. And it just really, I want people to buy the book. I want to read it and definitely read that chapter, because it exhibits both some of the bureaucracy, but also your tendency to be kind of a delinquent, HK, and I really appreciate that. One other thing that, I mean, I learned a lot from the book. One, I didn't really realize Iranian involvement in Bosnia was that substantial. Yeah. But also a real learning moment for me in your book was, and it really is highlighted in your chapter, Real Housewives of the CIA. In the military, they say when a soldier or an airman or a sailor deploys, the whole family mm-hmm. deploys. But in your yeah. case, in the CIA, that was quite literal. I mean, yeah. your wife
Assuming
and... Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, assuming it's a post that's an accompanied post. So, yeah, they were with me in Latin America, where our first daughter was born, while we were there. And then when I went to Belgrade, yeah, me and wife and two daughters. And the wife, in those days anyway, was very much a part of the team. She had to go through some intensive surveillance training with me in order to go to the denied area, as we called the former Soviet bloc and communist countries like Yugoslavia or Cuba or Nicaragua in those days. And so, it's a family affair. Now, when I went to Croatia and Bosnia and all of that during the war, obviously they were back in the U.S. So it depends on the post and the situation. But assuming things are more or less under control, the family goes too.
Was yours a unique situation, or when people sign on to marry someone in the CIA, they know what they're getting into, or that's kind of a surprise?
Well, yeah, it just depends. You know, I got married in law school, so she knew that I was going through the process, and she and I both spoke foreign languages at the time and loved foreign travel, and so she was very much up for it as well, although, as you saw in the book, it wasn't always as much fun as I promised it would be for her. But, you know, using her as bait to meet a KGB officer, and she was forced to go out one day as counter-surveillance, leaving her job in the embassy to accompany us to, well, we planted a listening device inside an enemy beach house in Latin America. And so, you know, it wasn't all fun and games for her, but she was a good sport.
Right. Boy, she must have been. Because it's not like, I can't remember the name of the Schwarzenegger movie, but you sort of picture that thing going on. But, wow. I would guess maybe this is what contributes to, I'm guessing the divorce rate in your former line of work is relatively high.
It's really high, and higher than the national average, which I assume is pretty high as well. So, yeah, it's hard. Yugoslavia was kind of the last straw in our case. We're still on good terms. And I think I also mentioned that, you know, even though we're divorced, and the CIA and way of life still affects her, because I recently, I've been in business in Iraq for almost 17 years now. That's why I say I'm all Iraq'd out. But several years ago, my oldest daughter was in college, and she knew that I was going to Kurdistan over Christmas vacation for work. And Kurdistan is a pretty safe place within Iraq. And even though the war was raging elsewhere in Iraq, I assured my ex-wife, you know, she wasn't happy that I wanted to take our daughter to Iraq for Christmas vacation. And I explained, look, I understand, you know, but Erbil, I said, you're never going to read about Erbil on the front page of the New York Times. Just, you know, that's how safe it is. So my daughter came with me to Erbil. Everything was fine. In the middle of the night, one night, I hear a helicopter, and so I look out my hotel window, and I see, you know, U.S. helicopter landing on top of a building a couple of blocks away. I found out the next day that that was U.S. Special Forces, and they had landed on top of an Iranian, so-called diplomatic building, and they grabbed a bunch of Quds Force members. And Soleimani was actually supposed to be with them, but he had split off from the group earlier in the day, so they didn't get Soleimani then. And the idea then was not to kill him, but to capture him, from what I understand. At any rate, we didn't, the U.S. military did not coordinate this with our Kurdish allies, and the Kurds were very upset, and there was even a standoff, brief standoff between Kurdish Peshmerga forces and U.S. forces the next day. It was a huge scandal. It was an international scandal to begin with, because essentially, you know, U.S. forces, from the Iranian point of view, kidnapped these Iranian diplomats. They weren't diplomats. They were Quds Force. These are the guys who tried to, you know, kidnap me and kill me in Sarajevo. At any rate, the whole incident, which took place in Erbil, was indeed splashed across the front page of the New York Times after I had assured my ex-wife that she would never, ever read about this place while my daughter was living there. So the fun never ends.
All right, if I can figure out in just a few minutes that wherever you go, trouble follows, I don't know that your ex-wife couldn't have, but that's okay. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're speaking with H.K. Roy. He's got a great book out called American Spy, Rye Reflections on My Life in the CIA. When we come back, I want to expand upon the next chapter of HK's life and leave you with a quote. Grandma paid one dinar to get into the colo and two to get out. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're spending some intriguing time with HK Roy, a man after my own heart, I guess I would say, in that both of us have a tendency to be somewhat on the delinquent side. Whether it's switchblades or fireworks, well, he went on to be much more sophisticated. I'll leave it at that, HK. You know, I left a quote, I left the listeners with a quote about grandma paid one dinar to get into the colo and two to get out. You decided, HK, that you could best serve your nation on the outside, and you started your own business. Tell us about that. You mentioned you're rocked out.
Right. Well, and that expression is it's a Serbian expression, which essentially means be careful what you wish for, or sometimes it's easier, you know, to get into something than it is to get out. And that was used in the context of both Iraq, where I've had a business for 17 years. And I said, you know, up front, I'm all Iraqed out. I'm going to hang out, you know, in my place in Mexico. And then in the epilogue, you may recall that I was back in Baghdad again last April. So sometimes, and just like with the CIA, sometimes it's easier to get in than to get out. And so when I resigned, I did start my own, first at like a consulting company, Business Intelligence, where I continued to operate like a CIA station. I collected intelligence overseas, primarily in the Balkans, Central and Eastern Europe, and the former Soviet Union. I ran agents, but the clients, for the most part, were not government, but corporate, you know, a big bank or a tobacco company, which is what led to the hunt for the war criminal later on in the book. But I didn't quit for the purpose of being able to help the government more, but it worked out that way. As I found out in Iraq, for example, where we had, I started my business there in May 2003, right when we thought the war was over. And the U.S. government wasn't interested in what I was doing, and that was fine. This was purely a private venture based on something I had done in Kosovo years earlier, and that very long story is in the book, too. At any rate, after a few years, my business in Iraq was doing quite well. We covered all regions of Iraq and all Iraqi employees. It was a very, and it still is, I'm still in business there. It's a very, it's an Iraqi registered company, Iraqi employees, and a lot of people don't even know that it's an American company. And so the U.S. government got wind of this and said, hey, you know, we can, if you're willing, we can work together. And because my company could do things that they could not do and go places they could not go. And I, of course, was happy to help. And so the bottom line is we had a very successful collaboration for many years, which was highly successful in counterterrorism terms, and it remained secret, and it was highly effective. Now, the government pulled the plug on it at the end of 2011 when U.S. troops left Iraq, even though meaning me and people inside the government who were running it, were saying, hey, this is supposed to be a stay-behind project. The bad guys are not going away. You know, we can continue to keep track of what's going on. We were in Mosul and Ramadi and Fallujah and Basra. We were everywhere in Iraq you want to be. And they said, nope, we're pulling the plug. So, okay, you know, they do what they want to do. A couple of years later, and precisely in June of 2014, there was this surprise ISIS takeover of Mosul, which is like the second or third largest city in Iraq, and everybody learned about ISIS, and which grew out of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And we were still operational in Mosul, and I was reading the news that the U.S. government was caught off guard. They knew nothing. They have no information coming from inside Mosul. And so I, you know, talked to my buddies in the government and said, hey, remember me. You know, we're still up and running in Iraq, and, this ISIS thing is important. You might want to reactivate the program. And they did not, which was mind-boggling. Had they kept it going instead of pulling the plug in 2011, there's a good chance it could have helped predict the rise of ISIS and help monitor it. There's a chance it could have helped prevent or at least diminish the takeover of Mosul. You never know. It's, you know, I can't say for sure. And my program was just one piece of the puzzle.
And HK, we've only got about 5 minutes left, but I really wanted to come back to that because you say the rise of ISIS was a surprise to some. It certainly wasn't to you and some of your comrades and other folks I've had on this show, but it sort of comes back to, and let me just throw out another quote from Sun Tzu, spies cannot be usefully employed without a certain intuitive sagacity. And for those of you whose mother were not an English teacher like mine, sagacity means to be discerning with a keen and farsighted penetration or judgment. So much of your experiences, HK, remind me, I almost envision, you know, George Washington is there on the banks of the Delaware, and a guy comes up and says, hey, you know, there's a big wide bridge down there that's unmanned. Why don't you cross there? And Washington's like, nah, we're going to take the boats.
Exactly.
You know, what is your take on, again, without getting too much into politics, the extent to which out here in the public so often we hear that we suspect it might be an intelligence failure, but in a lot of cases, apparently it's not. It's implementation, right, or a failure to take action or a miss. I don't know. I'm not here to challenge anyone.
And this is not political at all. This is the reality is, and there are a number of examples of this in the book that, those of us in the intelligence business or in the military or the FBI are apolitical. It's not about politics. It's not about who's in charge. We do our job, and that's how it should be, and this problem of ignoring intelligence is very bipartisan. I point out in the book that two Republicans and two Democrats presidents, they all screwed things up, in my view, in both Yugoslavia and Iraq. And a lot of times when they screw things up because they ignored the intelligence, they come back and blame the intelligence communities. Bad choice, but we're going to blame the intelligence. And the intelligence community cannot defend itself,
Bingo.
And it won't defend itself.
Bingo.
That's part of the reason I wanted to write this book, was to sort of set the record straight on a few things that happened in both Yugoslavia and Iraq, where, not to say that the CIA or any organization is perfect. You know, everybody makes mistakes, and they are wrong. But generally speaking, they kind of get the intelligence right, and politicians either ignore it or they want to see something that's not really there.
HK,
sort of.
I'd be remiss. We've only got now 2 minutes left, but I really want to tell us about Spookstock.
Spookstock is a sort of a secret fundraiser that takes place every year. It's a battle of the bands in D.C., and they have a celebrity judge and a celebrity band. Like last year was Lenny Kravitz. We've had ZZ Top, John Fogerty, Steve Miller Band, and it's a fundraiser for the CIA Officers Memorial Foundation and for Special Operations Military Foundation. We raise a lot of money to provide college educations to kids of CIA and Special Operations Military people who were killed overseas, not just pay for the education, but also sort of step in for the missing parent. It's a good thing. And that's I don't have the websites off the top of my head, but it's also
it's
at the back
secret.
Of the book. Semi-secret. It's now leaked out a little bit because it's becoming kind of a big event. But you'll have none of these people who show up, the Steve Miller Band or Robert De Niro or Harvey Keitel, who was a Marine in Vietnam, they do this out of the goodness of their hearts to help raise money. They don't get publicity for it. They don't get, other than what I've just said right now, and they don't get paid for it. And so it's really an amazing, amazing event, and they've raised a lot of money and helped a lot of kids.
So maybe a poor radio host who moderates a panel with H.K. Roy and Jonah Mendez will get an invitation. Or is absolutely. That not secret too forget about it.
No, absolutely. And then you can help spread the word.
I'm all
for
that.
Talk about that in Tucson.
Again, folks, H.K. Roy, American Spy, Wry Reflections on My Life in the CIA. Sir, you, honestly, you've got an odd sense of humor. I appreciate that, but you're a patriot nonetheless, and really want to thank you on what you have done and continue to do to protect us both at home and abroad.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate that, and thanks for having me on.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can find this podcast and hundreds of others with heroes both at home and abroad at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter at Warrior Radio TUC. We even have a Patreon page, patreon.com/AmericanWarriorRadio. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.